a youth. But that victory cost him. He could no longer see my bishop as an empty shell waiting to be filled. Even after 1,000 years, there was a good man in there, a man who finally remembered right from wrong. And when he did, I ripped him into pieces. Young, the pig, Ponala the springer, old bishop, O'Malley, old Visca, all dead by my hand, and Bello, beaten to a pulp, alive only because the shuttle's engines distracted me. Why am I like this? What's wrong with me? How many more will I kill? I am the wind, I say quietly. I am death. Bishop nods in solemn understanding. Someone has to be M. He glances at Barca, at Laffa, taking in their wounds. In every civilization, someone has to be. We're in visual range, Gaston says. 3 minutes from landing. The front wall view changes from a crystal clear picture of endless yellow jungle flowing by to a slightly shaking image of the crescent-shaped clearing. It curves away from us, as if we are approaching the bottom point of a quarter moon that is surrounded by tall trees. On that clearing, I see lines of tiny moving things, morning sunlight glinting off of metal, a long line of springers marching forward, muskets in hand. Then, from the trees on the opposite side of the wide clearing, 4 yellow machines scurry out. Spiders. We are too late. The battle is about to begin. 43. Gaston, get us there now, I say. Go faster! He nods. Give me maximum thrust! The shuttle lurches forward so violently that the floor beneath me can't accommodate fast enough. I almost lose my grip on the handhold. Laffa is chittering and chirping. I'm not sure if he's scared of the ride or dreading what he sees on the battlefield. Images on the pilot house wall gain detail as we close in. I see my people at the edge of the jungle, hiding behind trees and cowering in shallow ditches. Most of them hold tools that should be used for farming, and most of them are circles, fodder for Aramovsky's war. The springer lines stop. A staccato flash of glinting metal as hundreds of muskets take aim. As one, they fire and are obscured by a long grayish cloud of smoke. One of the advancing spiders slows to a stop. From the other 3, beams of white light shoot out, sweeping across the springers. Clouds of dirt and grass fly into the air, clouds that I know also contain meat and bone, blood and brains. Barca cries out, a howl that rends my heart. The remaining springers flee. What came forward as an organized line runs away as scattered individuals. But the spiders don't stop. On they march, to the middle of the clearing, beams blazing new holes, turning living beings into explosions of fluid and char and vapor. I feel so helpless. Damn it, Gaston, get us there! The pulls you're holding aren't designed for aggressive flight, he says. There's too much inertia to... Do it! We'll hold on! Put us between the springers and the spiders. We have to push our people back. Spingate looks away from the little images of light floating around her, locks eyes with me. We're in range for the shuttle's missiles, she says. We can destroy the spiders. The missiles? I'd forgotten that Gaston told me the shuttle has weapons. But if we destroy the spiders, will we kill whoever is riding them? If we had left a few minutes earlier, we might have stopped this. And now the only way to end it is if I order the death of my own people? The image before us now shows the battlefield in perfect detail. Torn earth, burning vines, smoldering corpses, severed limbs, springers, trying to crawl despite missing legs, or hopping around holding bloody stumps that used to be arms. In the motionless spider, I see 2 young circle stars and a tooth girl, unmoving behind the protective ridge, a pool of blood filling the deck beneath them. 30 seconds to landing, Gaston says. We're coming in fast, so this is going to be rough. Hold on tight. Em, I have missile lock, Spingate says. Do you want me to fire on the spiders? I open my mouth to say yes, but nothing comes out. Something rolls forth from the springer's side of the clearing. dozens of those strange wooden wagons Barca showed me. Springers pushed them along at a fast clip, wheels bounding over uneven ground. The wagons aren't empty anymore. Each one carries a boulder, bigger than the biggest Springer, a boulder wrapped in ropes. The long wooden tails no longer trail behind, but stick up at an angle, like some kind of off-center teeter-totter. A spider beam lashes out, catches one of the wagon's dead center. Springer bodies pop and burn. The wagon flames bright, becomes an instant inferno of wood and rope. The wagons halt. The wooden tails swing straight up, snapping tight the ropes around the boulders. The boulders swing backward, then up, then over. They streak through the air toward their targets. The heavy rocks hit the ground, bounce and roll at terrible speed. The first two whiz past the lead oncoming spider. The next one hits. Stone smashes into metal. The full-speed spider not only stops, it's thrown backward, metal shell now wrapped around the embedded boulder. A human body flies free, spinning limply. The spider flips and skids to a stop. Broken and twisted yellow legs stick up in the air. Two more riders stumble to their feet, disoriented, probably injured. Another boulder grazes the second spider, shearing off two legs as it rolls past. The spider crashes, spins wildly. Bodies fly, moving so fast and so violently that if the riders aren't already dead, they will be when they hit the ground. The other boulders sail past, all misses. They tumble across the clearing, losing speed, except for one. It must have hit a hard patch, because it sails higher like a ball bouncing off a floor. The boulder smashes into our side of the clearing, pulverizing human bodies. In a span of seconds, the outmatched Springers have destroyed two spiders and killed the crew of a third. Now I understand why the Springers wanted the spiders in one place. With that many wagons, at least some of the two dozen odd boulders were bound to connect. The last attacking spider's legs flash in a mad chopping motion as it slows, stops, and retreats. From the edge of the clearing, a fresh wave of Springers pours forth. I can't hear them, but I can see their open mouths, and I know they're bellowing a war cry. 20 seconds to landing, Gaston says. The Springer line closes in on the two spider riders, stranded in the middle of the clearing. The riders take cover behind their ruined machine. I silently urge them to run, but the smaller of the two clutches her arm to her chest, and the bigger one won't leave. There is just enough detail for me to make out who they are. It's Baudin and Zubiri. The shuttle lurches left. 15 seconds, Gaston calls out. I look to our side of the clearing to see what Aramovsky does next, and when I do, the trees themselves seem to move forward. It's a giant, a walking giant covered in vines, leaves, even whole trees jammed into gaps and spaces. One arm ends in a huge scoop shovel, the other in a pincer. It's the construction machine we saw in the spider nest. We're flying, but I swear I can feel the ground shake with each step of the huge metal feet. Laffa points at it, jabbers something fast and panicked, then re-grips his handhold as the shuttle shifts right. The Springers can't stop that thing, Bishop says. Muskets and rocks aren't going to do anything to that. Missiles will take it out, Spingate says. Em, what do we do? The giant's long strides eat up the distance. The Springers fire muskets at it, which doesn't slow it in the least. Everything is happening too fast. We can destroy it, but just like the spiders, I'll be killing my own people. Unless... Spin, hit the ground in front of the big machine, and also in front of the Springers. But try not to kill anyone. Do it now! Her hands grab symbols made of light. Launching, she says, her voice calm and level. The shuttle vibrates. Our view is temporarily blinded by spots of moving fire, then by streaks of smoke snaking out and away from us, some toward the Springers, some toward the giant machine. The smoke lines touch the ground. Expanding half spheres of dirt and grass rise up, driven by churning fireballs. The Springers are knocked away, hard, many of them lifted off their feet and thrown backward. A fireball rises up in front of the giant machine, splashing it with debris. Its lumbering ceases as the people inside it duck for cover. Rubble rains down onto the battlefield. Baudin covers Ubiri with her own body. I point to them. Gaston, put us down there, by that ruined spider. The shuttle banks to the right, throwing me hard against the handhold. The shuttle banks left, then up. Bishop loses his grip and tumbles away. He hits the door, bounces off it just as the shuttle levels out, trembles once, then stops. We're down, Gaston says. Bishop is on his stomach, moving weakly. Gaston, I say, tell Smith there are wounded on the field. Spingate, stay in the pilot house and be ready with the missiles. If I raise my left fist, you take out the giant, understand? Understood. Her gaze is steel. You know that will kill whoever is inside it, right? I nod. If I have to kill again to stop this, if I have to carry yet another haunting face around with me wherever I go, so be it. Lafa, Barca, move, I say. Bishop, get up. He looks hurt. More damage on an already brutalized body. Later I will feel sympathy for him. I'm not giving him the choice of staying down. He's struggling to his hands and knees. I'm coming. Just get out there and stop this. I run from the pilot house to find the shuttle doors already opening. I step onto the platform and am assaulted by the odors of battle. Metal, scorched wood, wet charcoal, burning mint, and a sickening stench of cooking meat. I slide my silver bracelet off my arm. I don't want to get blasted to bits if one of the kids mistakenly thinks I'm going to shoot Aramovsky. I hold the bracelet by the long point, raise it up high so all my people can see it. Then I throw it, as hard as I can. It spins through the air, gleaming in the morning sun. The point plunges into a bloody patch of fresh dirt. There it stands, open circles sticking up, almost like a gravestone marking the deaths of today's fallen. This is my chance, my one chance, to stop the slaughter. I push away my pain, my heartbreak, my fear. I square my shoulders, and I stride down the ramp like I own this world. Like an empress. War's crumbs dot the clearing's ravaged ground, twists of burned vines and clumps of soil, a torn springer, head and shoulder, smoke drifting up from the half-open toad mouth, a severed human hand, dark-skinned. Lafa limps down the ramp behind me. Barca hops out, confident and regal, despite his wounds and ravaged eye. Like me, he has pushed his pain down below. Prepared himself for this moment that will make all the difference. At the bottom of the ramp, the pair turn and hop toward the Springer lines, screaming as loud as they can. I can only hope they are telling their kind to stay back, to give me time to do what must be done. Three spiders stand not 10 strides away. They are battered and rusted, even more than the ones we first saw in the jungle. Their cannons, though, gleam and shine. The spiders on the left and right are each crewed by 3 kids, Aguirre, who must be the driver, and 2 black-clad circle stars armed with silver bracelets pointed directly at me. I know that if I make any sudden movement, they will fire. Standing on the middle spider, Aramovsky, the man who makes children go to war. He holds the spear. My spear. His red robes blaze in the morning sun. A long pointed bracelet adorns his right arm. Standing atop the spider's back, staring down with fury and excitement, he looks like an angry god of war. You told me to wipe out the vermin, he says. Now you've brought 2 of them with you? If you want to help me finish this, use those rockets to destroy their trebuchets. Like Bello, he thinks I'm Matilda. Of course he does. When he left the observatory, I was locked in a coffin. It could not possibly be a worse time to do it, but I can't stop myself. I start laughing. You know something, Aramovsky? You always thought you were smarter than me. It takes him a second to understand. His eyes flick to the springers. He snarls at me. Where is Matilda? As if in answer, the sky fills with a broken sound that quickly grows to a roar. I've heard that sound before, when Bello's ship came down, but this time, the ship is going up. I point to a line of smoke streaking into the sky. Matilda is there, probably with old Gaston. They left you, Aramovsky. And don't bother looking for Coyote, O'Malley, or Beckett, because they're all dead. His eyes narrow, so much hate in them. His hand squeezes on my spear, so tight the blade trembles. Knights, he says, kill this traitor. From the shuttle platform behind me, Bishop's voice booms out, echoing across the clearing. Hold your fire! No one moves. Aramalski thinks he speaks for the gods, but Bishop truly has the voice of one. The grown-ups are gone, Aramalski, Bishop says, and your time as leader is over. Aramalski's mouth opens. He looks rattled, but recovers quickly. He raises the spear over his head and shouts his answer. The vermin want to murder you in your sleep. Take away what the gods have given you. If Em and Bishop aren't with us, then they are against us. Do not listen to their blasphemous lies. The time has come to take this planet for ourselves. He points the spear to his right, up at the towering metal monster covered in vines and trees. Lead the assault! Crush the Springers! Please don't move. Please don't listen to him. The massive machine lifts a foot, extends it, sets it down with a thump that shakes the entire clearing. Barca must have stopped the Springers from attacking, but if the giant presses forward, then they will fight back. I have no choice. Aramalski, who is driving that thing? The monstrosity takes another thundering step. I hear the Springer horns sound all through the jungle. Abrantes and Aeschelman, he says. Both young halves, and two brave young knights, Cody and Cadote. You wouldn't know them, because you never talked to them like I did. Kids, would it be any better if it was people my age? No, not really. Why, Em? Aramalski spreads his hands, turning in place and speaking to everyone, like he always does when he's trying to make me look bad. Do you think you're going to talk them out of it? Maybe shout to the sky and the stars and the sun? Hope that they hear you? I shake my head. No, I just want to know who I killed. The monster machine takes another step. I raise my left fist. Spingate does not fail me. A hiss, a roar of flame. Two smoke trails shoot out from the top of the shuttle, covering the distance almost instantly. The missiles hit at the same time, one near the head, the other sliding into the chest. Fireballs erupt, billowing up to the sky and down to the machine's knees. A cloud of angry orange rises, driven higher by the column of flame beneath it. The vines catch fire, as do the full-sized trees jammed into the nooks and crannies. Every inch of the machine bubbles and burns. The fireball dissipates, replaced by a column of greasy black smoke. The machine moves no more. From inside it, I hear screams. The Springer horns fade out. On either side of the clearing, no one moves. With one gesture, I have demonstrated not only the ultimate power on this battlefield, but the willingness to use it. The Springers have no choice but to understand. If I'm willing to kill my own kind, I'm willing to kill them too. I am the wind. I am death. We all stand there motionless. We listen to the screams fade, then die out. The fire roars on. The machine that was made to build cities, then converted to kill, is now a colossus of flame and smoke. Aramalski stares at it blankly. He prepared well for this battle, far better than I expected. He had his people salvage spiders. He acquired weapons that gave him the advantage. He had children repair a machine that looked like it was rusted and long since worthless. He was led into a trap, but in the end, he might have won anyway. Three of the six spiders at his disposal are out of the fight. The Springers have probably reloaded their carts by now, and will assuredly take out at least one more spider, if not all three. Aramalski is vastly outnumbered, and his weapon of awe, the one thing the Springers could not possibly bring down with flying boulders, burns like the biggest bonfire ever created, the crew of four people inside it turning into ash. People that I killed. What have I done? I make choices, and people die. Bishop brushes past me. He's trying hard to hide a limp. Bleeding, his face swollen and cut, his coveralls ripped and torn, He squares his shoulders and stands in front of Aramovsky's spider. Knights, hear me, he shouts. You voted for Aramovsky, but he is false. Everyone he left behind was to be sacrificed to the grown-ups, so they could be overwritten. You are here only because there is no grown-up waiting to erase your mind. You are expendable. He spits that last word with a power I didn't know he possessed. With so much venom, it makes my hair stand on end. But he's not done talking. No one else has to die. The Springers showed M how to kill the red mold. We will have food, all we can eat. M did that, not Aramovsky. She killed my creator. She saved my life. I have fought beside M. I have bled with M. She is honorable. She is brave. She is willing to sacrifice for the greater good. She is not a knight, but she is everything we knights aspire to be. If you want to fight the Springers, you'll have to go through her. To get to her, you'll have to go through me. Bishop can barely stand, yet his words carry thunder. Where is the spoiled boy who bullied anyone who disagreed with him? That person was a child in a grown man's body. But like me, that child is gone. And more than that, he's bluffing. His legs tremble. He couldn't fight one young Circle Star, let alone all of them. This time, though, it isn't about Bishop's physical presence. The person who doesn't like to talk is ending this with his words. The spider on the left, a Circle Star, lowers her bracelet. Next to her, a Circle Star boy takes his hands off the cannon's controls and steps back. The spider crew on the right does the same. The little gear girl driving Aramovsky's spider swings a leg over the rail and descends, abandoning him. Aramovsky watches them all, eyes cold and consumed with rage. He's lost. He knows it. A tap on my arm. It's Barka. Him. He gestures toward Aramovsky. Move. We do. Barka and I walk to Aramovsky's spider. I climb the rungs. I stand before the red-robed leader of our people. Barka climbs up as well, then stands next to me, shoulder to shoulder. Human and Springer together, facing down a common enemy. Aramovsky sneers at me. The food doesn't matter, you gullible idiot. Don't you understand? They aren't human. This war will happen now, or it will happen later. Someday they will come for us. They will kill us because we aren't them. And if you're still alive, you'll know you sold out your own people to these monsters. The only monster here is you, I say. No more fighting. No more death. Aramovsky's chest heaves. There's a scream inside him, a scream that has no voice, no home. I know he is thinking the same thing I thought when he took the spear from me, that he can run me through, fight to keep what he believes is his and his alone. Slowly, gently, Barka draws the knife given to him by O'Malley, the knife with the double ring made of red stones, the knife with the blade as long as my forearm. The Springer Prince keeps the knife at his side. The tip points down, not at Aramovsky, but the message is clear. Aramovsky stares at it, eyes wide. Threatening an unarmed person is one thing. Facing an armed opponent is another. Barka and I are in this together, I say. You attack one of us, you attack both of us. You wanted to kill Springers, Aramovsky. Well, here's your chance. If you're going to fight, then do something with that spear besides just pose with it. The fingers of his bracelet hand twitch. Maybe he's wondering if he can fire twice before one of us gets to him. But I don't think he'll try. For him, the bracelet and the spear are little more than props. He is a leader, yes, but he is no warrior. When the time for speeches is past, when he must kill or be killed, Aramovsky's conviction turns to cowardice. He doesn't move. I wait, let everyone see he's afraid to back up his words with actions. I hold out my hand. If you won't do yourself what you ask others to do for you, then give me back my goddamn spear, you murdering bastard. We stare at each other. The universe fades away. There is only the two of us. Infinite moments pass by. Aramovsky breaks. He looks away. Without another word, he tilts the spear toward me. I take it. The cool wood feels nice in my hand. Remove that bracelet, Aramovsky, and get off my spider. I'll deal with you later. He slides the bracelet from his arm, lets it clatter to the spider's metal deck. As I watch him descend the rungs, I hear sounds of surprise and alarm from my people. While Aramovsky and I faced off, the springers, thousands of them, quietly closed in. Their line runs under the shuttle, winding around the landing gear, spreading out wide on either side. Some of them stare at the shuttle in open amazement, gawking at something their kind hasn't seen in generations. Far more stare at us, muskets leveled, enough that one volley would probably kill everyone. My people reply in kind, leveling bracelets, climbing to spider back, and manning cannons or crouching low with hoes and picks and axes and shovels. Even if all of us die in that first salvo, Spingate and Gaston remain safe inside the shuttle. If the Springers attack, I know she will unleash the shuttle's weapons, try to wipe out this violent species so that her unborn child may someday live safe and free. If I don't do something now, I haven't stopped the slaughter. I've only delayed it. Lower your weapons, I shout at my people. This fight is over. Some comply, some don't. Barca yells at his kind, loud and commanding. I don't know what he's saying, but the result is immediate. Most of the Springers lower their musket barrels. They haven't put their guns down, but they aren't aiming them at us either. We're doing it. Barca and I, together. We're going to stop this. Then, a bark of command from behind the Springer lines. The muskets snap up again, each one dead level, aimed at me, at Bishop, at the spider riders, at the children holding tools. My people do the same. We're one trigger twitch shy of a bloodbath. Another bark from behind the lines, somewhere under the shuttle. Straight out from my spider, the Springer line splits. Four of the biggest Springers I've seen yet hop forward, their muskets aimed at me. Bluish-red skin, marked with scars, weapons strapped to their bodies, axes, knives, swords. Any one of them looks like a match for Bishop when Bishop is at his best. Two of them move slightly to the right, two slightly to the left. From between them hops forward an old Springer, one whose blue skin is turning ashen and gray. Hanging from his neck is an ornate copper plate. Barca's parent, the Springer King. I angle my spear toward the Springer Prince. Barca looks at it. After watching Aramovsky give it to me, I think he understands the weapon's significance. Your turn, I say. I'm afraid I can't do the talking here. I give the spear a little shake. Together. We do this together. His two good eyes, two alert, pain-filled eyes, look at me. Him. Peace. I nod. Peace. His right hand reaches out, grips the spear. As one, we raise my people's symbol of leadership. Barca talks. I don't understand a word he says. I see Springer's guns waver, see the aliens looking at each other, looking at their ruler. Perhaps some emotions are constant in any intelligent species. These Springers are confused. They are being told two things and don't know which is true. The Springer King's entire body contorts. His eyes widen. His lips angrily curl back, show teeth. He screams at Barca. He turns and screams at his people, first to the left, then repeating the same thing to the right. And then I hear something soft, something nearly silent. If I wasn't standing right next to Barca, our arms together raising the spear, I wouldn't have heard it at all. The sound sends a chill up my spine, tells me that something is horribly wrong. It is the sound of broken glass. Quietly, to himself, Barca is laughing. Laughing like a person who was watching a plan unfold, like someone who knew exactly what was going to happen. The Springer King turns to face us. He says something, and the bodyguard on his right hands over his musket. The Springer King puts the butt to his thin shoulder. He aims it at us. He says something else, something angry, definitive and commanding. I again hear Barca's tiny broken glass laugh. The prince raises his left arm. He's wearing Aramovsky's bracelet. I freeze. I didn't even see him pick it up. I stare. So does the king. That sense of command, of absolute authority. It leaves his eyes. For a horrible moment, I can read his emotions. Shock. Disbelief. Betrayal. Barca flicks his two fingers forward. The beam lashes out. White fire engulfs the king. The aliens scream. A sound I will never be able to forget. Lasts only a split second, then ends forever as his body rips into 100 pieces. Blue blood and meat chunks splatter on the springers behind him, splash his bodyguards with charred gore. The spear is yanked from my hand. Barca raises his arms, the spear held in one hand, the other hand outstretched, letting the morning sun glisten off his bracelet. He talks for a few seconds. Again, I don't know what he says, but I don't have to understand the words to see their effect. The long, seemingly endless line of Springer guns hovers, flutters, lowers. One or two at first, then in a wave, until all the muskets point down at the ground. One by one, the Springers lower their heads. They drop. They kneel. There must be 100 bodies scattered across the battlefield, humans and Springers alike, shredded by weapons, both primitive and advanced. And I suddenly wonder if it didn't have to be this way, if Barca could have stopped all of it. But he didn't want to. Maybe what he really wanted was to become the leader of his people. As with many things, maybe our two races are more alike than we are different. Barca wanted power. The Springer Prince? No, the new king turns to me. He thonks the spear butt on the deck, leans the tip toward me, offering me the weapon. Him. Peace. Yes, peace. At what cost? And for how long? I take the spear. Well, I don't know what the future holds. This battle, at least, is finished. Epilogue. It is a beautiful day on Omeokan. The reddish sun beats down. Blurred wings sparkle in the light. I smell fresh baked bread and roasting meat. We will eat well tonight. A short distance from the observatory, Mueller slows my spider. He's done this enough times now that he doesn't need to be told what to do. The child soldier stops us in front of the black X, lowers the machine's belly. Metal clangs against stone. No more vines on this street, as we clear them away. Mueller, or Victor, as he prefers to be called, missed the battle entirely. Matilda locked him in an observatory cell. Once things calmed down, we found him and let him out. He's a circle star, so he's still somewhat bitter he didn't get a chance to fight. Like most kids with his symbol, he's constantly eager to prove himself. If I have my way, he'll never get that chance, because we'll never fight again. I hand him my spear. Hold this for a moment. He takes it, holds it as if it's a magical talisman. Maybe he'll hold it permanently one day. If so, he'll find out if it's far more burden than blessing. I climb out. The black X is bent and twisted from the fire's heat. We moved it out here into the open, where it serves as a monument to the people and Springers who died in that fire. Hello, Kevin, I say. I'm sorry I didn't make it yesterday, or the day before. Callie and Wallazak got into a fight. Callie is working to see if there's a way to get our Bello back. She might be in there somehow, just like you were. Wallazak says it's a sin, and that grown-up Bello's wisdom and experience are too valuable to lose. Something like that. Anyway, they got into a fist fight, if you can believe it. Oh, and I had to check on the first crops. I told you they found corn seeds in the food warehouse, right? Kevin doesn't answer, of course. He never does. His bones are buried here along with his progenitors, coyotes, old bishops, and those of the other grown-ups who died in the observatory battle. I wonder if they, too, listen to me when I talk. I can't stay long today, I say. Spingate sent for me. Said she found something really important. She wanted Borjigin and Barca, too. I'll come back and tell you what it is as soon as I can, okay? Kevin doesn't answer. Spin is really close to having the baby, I say. Smith says it could be any day now. Hard to believe how much time has passed since Gaston told everyone she was pregnant. He said if it's a boy, they will name it after you. Isn't that nice? Kevin doesn't answer. I reach out, lay one hand on the twisted black metal. It's hot from baking in the sun. The first few times I did this, it made me cry. But I don't cry anymore. Not every time, anyway. I miss you, I whisper. I miss you so much. Mueller softly clears his throat, reminding me I'm already late. I turn away from the X, scale the spider and stand next to the young circle star. He hands me my spear, then urges the spider on without saying a word. Since the standoff in the clearing, Mueller has become my driver and assistant of sorts. Bishop calls him my bodyguard. Mueller is taller than me now. He's our best marksman, and I've seen him training with his knife, hatchet, and fists. His lanky frame belies his ability as a gifted, deadly fighter. I hate to think I actually need a bodyguard, but I know I do. As the leader of my people, I'm a target for the Springers that want to drive us out. We still can't fully trust them. Perhaps we'll never be able to. And then there is the constant fear that Matilda and the grown-ups will return. For all we know, they're here already. Gaston thinks they could fly a ship to the far side of Omeokan and land without us knowing. The thought is terrifying, but also galvanizing. Barca and the Springers understand the grown-ups are the ones that savage their race for generations, not us. If grown-ups attack, they will be met with unified resistance. While our problems with the Springers are many, having a common enemy outweighs them all. Mueller drives the spider to the observatory. Once again, he lowers the war machine's belly to the ground. Shall I escort you in, Em? I'm sure he wants to protect me, but there is another reason he'd like to come inside. I can make it on my own, thank you. You don't mind staying out here, do you? He looks crestfallen. Like most of the Circle Stars, Mueller can't hide his emotions. It's so easy to tease him. Oh, wait, I say. I'm seeing Spingate and Zubiri might be with her. Zubiri isn't the real reason you want to go with me, is it? He shakes his head. No, I'm supposed to stay with you is all. Honest, Bishop told me to. I can't help but laugh at him. It's all right, you can come. It's funny when I think about it, but in a way, Aramovsky got his wish. Part of it anyway. He wanted us all to live in the observatory. Turns out that was an excellent idea. In the days following the battle, we were unsure of Barca's intentions as the new Springer leader. We couldn't stay in the shuttle anymore, as it was too crowded, but we also needed a place that was defendable. We're still outnumbered at least 1,000 to 1, something I can't ignore. Barca can't possibly control all of his kind. The observatory gives us the space we need, and has only a few entrances, which we can seal up tight. Borjigin's progenitor was trained to manage buildings, guide construction and repair, do all the things needed to make a city operate. Our Borjigin discovered the observatory has lights, clean running water, temperature control, everything we need. The telescope part doesn't work, though. Apparently it needs a different kind of power. Zubiri figured out that the power source was in the room where O'Malley died, at the bottom of the shaft surrounded by that red metal wall. The fire destroyed the power cable, and also dropped some debris on top of the power source, breaking it. Zubiri, Spingate, and the other gears have been working for a long time to fix it. The observatory has thousands of rooms, more than enough for everyone to have their own space. Aramovsky's wish came true for him, especially. He's locked in a stone cell in the building's lower levels, the same cell Mueller was locked in, actually. Bella was locked in another cell. If she and Aramovsky shout loud enough, they can sort of hear each other. They'll stay in those cells until I'm damn good and ready to figure out how to put them on trial for their crimes. There was even space for the 100 red-skinned Springers that live with us. Some train with Spingate and the scientists, some with Bishop and the Circle Stars, some with Smith for medicine, some with the haves for civil engineering and management. It's part of Barca's and my effort to bridge the gaps between our species, to create cooperation and harmony. And some of the young Reds work with our plain old circles. Just like with humans, not every Springer is cut out for math, science, planning, or war. It breaks my heart, but Okereke, Johnson, Cabral, and Ingolfson still don't seem interested in learning a particular skill. I've asked them. If someone tells them what to do, they're happy to do it. And most of the 12-year-old circles, who are now closer to 13, feel the same way. Out of all the circles, only a handful of kids and D'Souza seem interested in becoming something other than what they were designed to be. Some of those ambitious circles are out in the jungle, living with the Springers. Just as we have much to teach them, they have much to teach us. D'Souza leads the effort of learning how to farm and prepare food, how the Springers gather, hunt, and trap. I talk to D'Souza. Her first name is Maria, at least twice a day. She's learning the Springer language, learning to be a Springer in much the same way that Bishop teaches Mueller how to be a knight. Maria gives me hope that I'm not the only one capable of being something more than the grown-ups designed us to be, that any of us can create our own destiny. If it sounds like our two races are getting along well, they aren't. If we could have ended the battle before it began, then maybe we could have all been friends. But 213 Springers died that day. Another 100 or so bear permanent injuries. We lost 14 people and have permanent injuries of our own. No matter how many times Barca and I tell everyone that we're all working together now, each race distrusts the other. We are just too different. There have been fights between our races, mostly with fists, some with weapons. We've had people beaten and cut. Our kids are told to never go out alone, especially at night. If it wasn't for our circle crosses and the observatory's medical facilities, our death toll would have climbed higher still. Springers, too, have been hurt as some of our youth have sought to repay violence with violence. But we're trying, and as devious as Barca turned out to be, he's trying too. I invited the entire Springer population to move into Ukmal, so the city walls could keep out those predators lurking in the jungle. A few accepted, most declined. The sins of our creators won't fade overnight, not to mention the fact that we use spiders constantly. For any Springer, the sight of those metal monstrosities still fills them with terror. Instead of moving into our city, the Springers are rebuilding their own. They finally have the opportunity to live above ground. They're starting small, working with a few of the hexagonal buildings that had the least damage. Finally free from the constant threat of spiders, they are even trying to build their first factory so they can mass-produce goods for farming, hunting, construction, and more. Making each item by hand takes too long. I even have two of the kids who were stored in the shuttle, Boriso and Nevins, helping them design a rifle to replace their muskets. As for Bishop and me, I want to spend more time with him, and he wants to spend more time with me, but the things we have done haunt us both. Being around each other reminds us of those things. I know he's working just as hard as I am to build our new way of life. For now, that is enough. I gaze up at the massive observatory. We've lived here for 271 days now. Opkik has kept a close count, yet the size still staggers my imagination. Borjigin estimates this building alone took the machines 20 or 30 years to make. The whole city? Probably along the lines of a half century. We haven't cut the observatory's vines, because they mostly cover up horrible images that none of us need to see. We'll get rid of those images someday, but for now, there are more important things to do. We found a total of 3 ground-level entrances into the observatory. We think there is at least one more, though. A secret exit from the main room that Matilda and old Gaston must have used to escape. She helped design the city after all. The secret she knows will hurt us if she ever comes back. Our main entrance is the one Barca used to rescue us. The same entrance young Springers used for years to explore the observatory and steal food stored there. Seems our wrapped packages were more than just a trophy for young Springers who proved their bravery by entering the city and risking spider attack. Our food is something of a delicacy to them. Right now, it is a central unit of trade between races. They get crackers and protein bars and cookies. We get fruit and vegetables, meat, grains, and a certain kind of tree bark. Turns out bark is absolutely delicious. Come on, I say to Mueller. Let's go see your girlfriend. His face flushes, but he doesn't deny it. I should really stop teasing him so much. At the observatory entrance, Barca, Laffa, D'Souza, and Borjigin are waiting for me. Barca still has Kevin's knife in his belt. Every time I meet the Springer leader, I can't help but notice that. D'Souza no longer wears black coveralls. Strips of colored cloth are tied around her arms, legs, stomach, and strategically around her waist and chest. Her beautiful brown skin is even darker now, as she spends every day in the jungle. She carries a Springer bag, a hatchet tucked into her belt, and a musket slung over her shoulder. Barca wears a patch over his ruined middle eye, but the two remaining green eyes are bright, full of excitement for life. He loves his role as the leader of his people. Him, he says. Feel well? Today? I can't help but smile. Barca is picking up our language. I only wish I was as good at picking up theirs. Yawap, I say. Talik? Talik Cree? Laffa's frog mouth trembles like she's trying to hold something back. Then it opens wide with grinding glass laughter. We now know he is a she. Her leg is fully healed, thanks in no small part to young Pocono, the Circle Cross who has chosen to focus specifically on Springer physiology. I look to D'Souza. What is she laughing at? I tried to say I feel fine. Close, she says. You said, I feel poop on my face. I laugh embarrassed. Laffa laughs harder. Barca growls at her. She stops, but her body continues to shake with held back amusement. The two of them go everywhere together. Laffa has an unstoppable sense of humor, which is good, because Barca doesn't seem to have one at all. Borjigin is impatient. He looks at the thin rectangle in his hands, which he calls a message board. He and Opkik found several of them in an observatory storeroom. They use them to get information when they are out in the city or the jungle, far away from pedestals. We're late, he says. Can we please stop joking about feces and get inside? I'm the leader of the people, but Borjigin is in charge of extending the reach of power and clean water, the continuous searching of unexplored buildings, a thousand other things necessary to make this city livable. He works even harder than I do, and, like Barca, has little time for jokes. We're about to enter when Okereke, Johnson, and a young circle named Mehmet walk out. They are covered in mud and greasy char. They stink of dirt and some kind of mineral scent I can't place. They are laughing and excited. You're filthy, I say to Okereke. What have you three been up to in there? Helping Spingate, he says. And Zubiri. Helping with what? He shakes his head, all smiles. She made us promise not to say anything until she talked to you first. But it's really amazing. Borjigin's fingers drum impatiently on the message board. Fine, I say. Borjigin, lead the way. The hallway we used to flee the fire is now illuminated by a glowing ceiling rather than torchlight. The floor is swept clean. The stone walls are spotless. The long walk brings us to the room where Coyote's mind was erased, where old Dr. Smith burned to death, where Springer's died, where I shot old Bishop and stabbed O'Malley. I wish we could center things elsewhere, but Spingate and Gaston both insist this room was designed to be the hub of all the observatory's abilities. While I will never recover from those memories, the room looks completely different. The golden coffins have been moved elsewhere in the building, and modified by Smith and Pocono to become sources of health and healing rather than destruction. The burned ceiling was scraped away, painted white, all the lights repaired. We covered up that horrible mural. We found a storeroom with replacement pedestals. A half dozen of them adorn a rebuilt platform, and a dozen more are set up in the space the coffins once occupied. Despite all the cleaning and painting, this place still smells faintly of smoke and scorched flesh. Every time I come in, I look at the spot where O'Malley died. Springers and kids alike study at the floor pedestals. Some are learning math and science, Some are helping develop Borjigin's plan for the city. Spingate Gaston and Zubiri are standing on the platform. Spingate's belly is curved with the life growing inside of her. She walks funny now, has to in order to balance the weight. Smith says the baby is overdue. Gaston has grown something too, a beard. It is thick and black, and it annoys Bishop. As big as Bishop is, all he can manage is a thin blonde scraggle. Gaston is fond of saying that facial hair defines being manly, and will continue to say so until it stops enraging Bishop. And then there is Zubiri. Most of her face has been repaired. Smith is still working on replacing her missing teeth. 5 of them are in and set, 3 more to go. I'm told that after the next operation, Zubiri should have her smile back. The one thing she can never have back, though, is her left arm. She lost it in the battle. It was torn off in the spider crash, severed just above her elbow. Smith could do nothing for that. Coffins can do miracles on skin and bone, fixing up that which is damaged, but regrowing body parts is beyond the technology's abilities. Spingate looks up from her work. She sees Mueller, smiles. Grandmaster Zubiri, she says, can you go to the shuttle and bring me back the bracer from storage? And M, I need Zubiri back here sooner rather than later. Would you mind if Victor gives her a ride? Zubiri and Mueller, I correct myself, Victor, stare at each other. I'm not sure they even remember I'm here. I don't mind at all, I say. Just don't be gone all day. We won't, the two of them say in unison, and they rush out of the room before we can change our minds. We've learned that Zubiri is brilliant. Genius is the word Spingate uses to describe her. Perhaps someday soon, Zubiri will lead these research efforts instead of Spingate, but the girl's mind isn't always on her work. Maybe if she hadn't had her arm ripped off and her face smashed so hard she needed 11 reconstructive surgeries. Maybe, even if she didn't wake up every night screaming in horror as she relives that moment, then she could concentrate more. And of course, maybe if she wasn't in love with a boy. Gaston is staring at an image of stars hovering above a pedestal. He waves us to join him. I step onto the platform. It's wide enough that Barca and Lafa can come up with me. Borjigin stays on the floor, looking at his message board and talking to D'Souza. So I'm here, I say to Spingate. What's so important that Barca and I both had to come? She looks at the Springer, as if wondering if she made a mistake to ask for him. She shakes her head, chasing away that thought. Whatever this is, it must affect both species equally. Zubiri fixed the power supply in the hole, she says. I look to the red wall in the room's center, realize that a heavy black cable is running up from the hole, over the wall, and under the pedestal platform, a cable just like it burned up in the fire. Spin, that's great. Does that mean the telescope is working? Sort of, she says. First, I have to tell you what we found in the hole. Only Zubiri, myself, and a few other young gears have been down there. Until today. Today we needed Okariki to take the heavy cable down and connect it. He saw things in the walls that the rest of us hadn't noticed. She picks up a box that is sitting on the platform. It's filled with dirty objects. Borjigin, I need your expertise, she says, and pulls out a piece of masonry from the box. Can you tell me what this is? He and D'Souza join us on the platform. The bit of masonry is flat on two sides, broken on the other. It looks like a small chunk of a corner of a building, but the angle is wider than 90 degrees. A piece of Springer building, Borjigin says. 120-degree angle. Their specific type of concrete. You can tell because they like to mix in wood mulch. He points to several small air spaces in the concrete. They look like slots where wood splinters would fit in perfectly. Spingate nods. That's what I thought, too. It was found in the dirt walls of the hole, the layer just below the floor of this room. Borjigin nods. Of course. The grown-ups leveled the Springer City and built on top of it. There's going to be all kinds of debris buried beneath Ukmal. Spingate seems nervous. She takes another piece from the box, offers it to him. This was below that layer, she says. What is it? It's flat on one side, melted and torn on the other. It's not masonry. I've never seen anything like it. Vortigern stares at it. He turns it over. I don't know what it is, he says. Some kind of composite. A support beam, maybe? I haven't seen this material in any Springer architecture, and it isn't in anything built by the grown-ups. You said it was below the Springer layer? Spingate nods, reaches into the box. The whole layer is full of it. Okereke found this as well. She hands him what looks like a plastic doll, or perhaps a small statue. This I recognize. The body is the same reverse-legged shape as the statues in Barca's church. Two back-folded legs, two lower arms, two arms coming out the sides of the one-eyed head. Vortigern shrugs. I don't know what that is. Barca gently takes it from Vortigern. Boo, Velen, the Springer says, examining it. Colo regatta jumain. Words I don't know. I glance at D'Souza. He's talking about the Velen, she says. The Alban Den won't tell me much about them. Alban Den. It's still hard for me to get used to that word. That's the name of Barca's tribe. D'Souza insists we all use it instead of Springers, but most of my people ignore her. Is Velen another tribe? I ask. D'Souza shakes her head. I think Velen is the name of their gods, because the rest of what he said roughly means those who came before us. Barca sets the plastic doll back in Spingate's box. Vortigern shakes his head. Spingate, are you saying that not only did we destroy the Springer city to build Ukmal, but the Springers destroyed an earlier city, populated by another race to build theirs? But that can't be. The Springers were here first. My race wanted their land, slaughtered them, nearly wiped them out. Does this discovery mean that the Springers weren't just part of the natural balance of Omeokan? That they, too, demolished what came before them to take over this land? Spingate shrugs. I'm just saying that these layers are in the hole. Okereke said the hole goes much deeper, and it looks like there are even more layers. He didn't descend past the power source, though. He said it felt too creepy. This is making my head fuzzy. Our creators destroyed the Springers, who maybe destroyed these Velen. Did the Velen destroy another race before them? And if so, why are so many races building a city in exactly the same place? We'll have to go down there, I say. You were right to bring Barca and me both in for this. Spingate shakes her head. She seems nervous, maybe upset. That's not the main reason I asked you here, she says. I said we sort of fixed the telescope. What I mean is, there are two kinds. She points a finger up. The Goffspear telescope, the big optical one in this building, still isn't working. Without Okadigbo, we just don't know what's wrong with it, let alone how to fix it. But it turns out there are other telescopes in the city and in the jungle, radio telescopes. We got those working. They've been feeding us information for a few hours now. And we found something. Gaston, show her. Gaston waves his hands over a pedestal. Above it, a green, blue, and brown sphere appears. Omeokan, spinning slightly. Above that is a red point of light. Farther out, and in a different direction, a blue point. He points to the red one. That represents the Xolotl. Just the name of that ship calls up so many awful memories. But if that red dot is the Xolotl, what's the blue dot? I point to it. I'm guessing this is what you really brought us here to see.
You guessed right, Gaston says.
Do you know what a radio wave is? I shake my head. Think of when you're out in the city, he says. Sometimes when you yell very loud, it sounds like your words bounce back to you. I nod, especially with big buildings around. Radio waves are like that, only on a larger scale, he says. They go out into space. The observatory sends out this radio signal. Think of a ball that keeps getting bigger and bigger at the speed of light. When the radio waves hit something, they bounce back to Omeokan, where the radio telescopes detect them. He points to the red light again. This is from the radio waves hitting the Xolotl and bouncing back. It takes me a second to understand what that means. The red light is the Xolotl, a ship in orbit.
So the blue light is... This can't be. It can't. You're telling me there is another ship out there? Spingate nods. She's staring at the dot, gently pulling at her lower lip with her thumb and forefinger. In a way, she didn't look this afraid even when the Springers were beating the hell out of us. Gaston notices, puts his arm around her shoulders, gives her a light squeeze. Definitely another ship, he says. Almost as big as the Zolotl. And it's coming our way. Since I woke up, I think I've spent every day in fear. Afraid for my life, for the lives of others. But this fills me with a new sense of foreboding. More grown-ups, I say. They're coming for us. Gaston huffs. I wish. At least we'd know what we're dealing with. We haven't been able to fully recover the observatory's memory. But I did get some information on the path the Zolotl took to get here. This new ship is on a completely different trajectory. I stare at him instead of the blue dot. Maybe you could say that in words I could understand? It's not more grown-ups. He lets go of Spingate, taps the red dot. A line extends from it, arcing away to my left, away from Omeokan. That's the path the Zolotl took to get here, he says. He taps the blue dot. Another line appears, curving away and to my right. That is the path the new ship took. The ships came from completely different areas of space. It took the Zolotl 1,000 years to reach this planet. That new ship could have been traveling equally long, but from another direction. If it's not the grown-ups, I say, then who? When Gaston speaks, his voice is quiet and steady, free of any trace of the mockery or bravado that usually define him. When the grown-ups got here, they destroyed the Springer civilization. Based on what Okariki found in the hole, we think the Springers destroyed another race that was here before them, meaning the Springers are probably from somewhere else, just like we are. 3 races have occupied the same area. So who is in that new ship? My guess is it's a 4th race. And based on what the grown-ups did when they arrived, and what the Springers probably did when they arrived, we have to assume this 4th race isn't coming here for milk and cookies. No one speaks. The blue dot blinks softly. I couldn't have possibly anticipated this. No one could have. We earned peace. An uneasy peace, certainly. But humans and Springers are working together, trying to build bridges that will lead to us sharing this planet. Not as one people, perhaps, but as cooperative neighbors. We fought for that. And now a tiny point of blue light tells me it might all be for nothing. How long? I say. How long until it arrives? Gaston scratches his beard. About 200 days. We don't know what it is. We don't know what's in it. We don't know if it is friend or enemy. Spingate clears her throat. It's likely they detected our radio wave, so they know that we know they're coming. We're trying to figure out how to send a communication, but we're not sure how to do that, or if they would even understand. Should we? The room speaks, cutting her off.
Grandmaster Spingate, Ometeotl says. Contact Gamma 1 detected.
Farther out from Omeokan, past the blue dot, and in yet another direction, a yellow dot appears. Spingate and Gaston say nothing. Is that the sun? I ask. One of the 2 moons? Spingate slowly shakes her head. The Zolotl is labeled Alpha 1. That was the first thing the radio wave detected. Then it detected the blue dot, which we labeled Beta 1. The wave keeps expanding, continues to detect things that are farther out. Her hands rub absently at her swollen belly. Gaston turns quickly to another pedestal. He calls up glowing symbols, grabs them, moves them, turns them. The yellow dot grows a line. It points out into yet another area of space.
A 3rd ship, he says,
his voice flat, stunned. Estimated time to orbit? 281 days. Maybe it's a ghost image or something. Or an asteroid. Or...
Grandmaster Spingate. Contact Delta 1 detected.
A green dot appears. This time, I don't have to ask what it is. It's all too clear. Gaston works the controls.
Getting the estimated time to orbit, he says. Roughly 332 days.
Three ships, out there in the blackness of space. They are all coming from different directions. They are all coming here.
Our fight for Omeokan is long from over.
This concludes the audiobook of A Light, Book 2 of the Generations Trilogy. Written by Scott Sigler. Read by Emma Galvin. Produced by Adrian Galvin. Engineered by Steve Rickyberg. Copyright 2016 by Empty Set Entertainment. All rights reserved. This has been a presentation of Empty Set Entertainment. If you would like to learn more about Scott Sigler and listen to his free weekly serialized audiobooks, please visit